Mr., I'm not even going to try to pronounce it, so you start.
May it please the court, Bill Cagle for the CACI interveners, Your Honor. The political question doctrine bars both these actions. In both actions here.
So if Congress passed a statute regulating contractors, courts couldn't enforce that statute because of the political question doctrine?
It'd be a very fact-specific situation, Judge Kavanaugh.
Okay, court, let me try to make it fact-specific. Congress passes a statute saying that contractors are subject to private civil liability if they engage in torture. Can a court enforce that congressional prohibition?
Only to the extent that it would not intrude on strategy and tactics on the battlefield made by the United States. That activity...
Hasn't Congress made a judgment on that when they enact the statute?
It'd obviously be a closer question than present here, because if the executive affirmatively seeks a determination of judicial review, then it's much more difficult to argue that the political question doctrine bars that review. But in this instance, where the prosecution of war is committed exclusively to the executive and the legislative branches and not to the judiciary, the strategy and tactics employed on the battlefield are simply not subject.
That's what I don't get. The judiciary clearly has a role in regulating, policing certain wartime issues. That's from Youngstown through Boumediene. We've seen that. And the question in those cases usually is whether the executive has transgressed a boundary set by Congress or by the Constitution.
Or by the Constitution.
And the political question doctrine would have said courts shouldn't get involved in any of those cases, and rather, except with the question of actually declaring war, which is still the subject of some dispute in the case law, courts have gotten involved in all sorts of wartime questions.
Those wartime questions have been limited to statutory or constitutional rights. For example, in Hamdi or Boumediene, where there were statutory right to habeas corpus involved in the one instance, and a constitutional right to habeas corpus involving an enemy combatant in the other, the courts clearly have staked out appropriately the jurisdiction to review and to enforce those rights, both statutory and constitutional. Neither are present here. In this instance, we're dealing with plaintiffs.
I guess that's, you can gerrymander the political question doctrine that way, but usually the doctrine would say the whole area is just not for the beyond the competence of the courts.
Certainly with respect to the facts presented here, that's correct. In response to Judge Garland's question about whether we're talking about field preemption or conflict preemption, I think there's a passage in Garamundi that's relatively instructive. If there is an area that is committed exclusively to the federal government in which the states have no role to play, and keeping in mind that the Constitution affirmatively forbids the states from engaging in the calculus of waging war, in an area where the states have no traditional competence, where there is no traditional area of state concern, it might well be appropriate to find field preemption. On the other hand, where there is an area...
Garamendi helps you on preemption. Does it really help you on political question?
I think by analogy it does.
Is your position that... we said in Harbury that it matters much whether the executive has filed something. And in fact, interpreting all of our previous cases, it noted in all those cases, the executive had said that there was a problem, either a scope of employment problem, or that is, it was within, or that it was a political question, and that we should be careful, maybe a little bit more. The political question doctrine ordinarily would not apply to a court case unless the government has affirmatively come in and said so. This takes us pretty far past our previous cases, doesn't it?
I have two responses to that, Judge Garland. First, the that action and the other decisions from this court, such as Gonzalez, Vera, or Schneider, or Bancold, all involved claims brought against United States government officials in which the United States was, in fact, represented. The United States, therefore, had to take a position in those cases with respect to the implications for foreign affairs. In this action, the United States is not a party. The plaintiffs have sued neither the United States nor any government personnel.
I understand, but you're taking the position in this case and in your other case that this is deadly important to the United States, that it would be a disaster for the United States war-making powers if it didn't, if that weren't preemption here. There's no question that the United States knows what's going on in this courtroom. It's a publicized case, and there have been letters back and forth with the Army. So if it really is as important as you say, the fact that the government isn't a party here hardly prevents it from filing an amicus brief, which it has done in other cases.
That's correct, Your Honor, it has, although generally in claims brought against contractors, it has not been the practice of the United States. In cases brought against contractors arising from the war in Iraq, to file amicus briefs or to intervene.
I know that, but the question is, what should we take from that?
I don't believe you can draw any significance from that, Judge Garland. In fact, the Supreme Court has never laid down a requirement that for the United States to file a statement of interest or otherwise participate in an action.
Has there ever been a case where, I have no idea what the answer to this is, where court found a political question where the government didn't argue that there was a political question?
I believe that occurred last year in the Carmichael decision in the Northern District of Georgia, in which the district court dismissed the action on the political question doctrine after finding that the military's responsibility for convoys.
I guess I meant whether there was a court of appeals or Supreme Court opinion.
I'm not aware of one.
Let me ask, just to be sure I understand your political question point. Your point is that if the government hires a contractor and does not supervise, let's say the contract expressly says, you're on your own, buddy, that's a political question?
If the government chooses to exercise control of the contractor in that manner, that's correct.
It's still a political question.
It's still a political question.
So none of the elements that counsel here is arguing for with respect to Garamendi or with respect to Boyle would apply. So if the government hires a contractor and says, does the government have to say go to Iraq? I mean, does it at least have to direct the contractor go to Iraq?
For purposes of preemption or purposes
of
political question?
Political question.
I would anticipate that for purposes of the political question doctrine, a contractor would need to be engaged with the United States in a way that would implicate policies formulated and adopted by the United States, because that's precisely the problem here. It's impossible to litigate these cases without...
I thought that at least your co-counsel here is taking the position the way you know that the policies of the United States are implicated is that the United States actually supervises. And I take it you're arguing for something much broader, which is all the government has to do is hire the contractor without any constraints of any kind, and at least send them to Iraq, or anywhere in Iraq, even in a non-combat zone, or do we have to decide whether there's a combat zone?
I'm not certain it goes that far, Your Honor, but it's certainly not the fact scenario presented
I know,
to
but
this
I,
court.
I, you know,
and the political...
I said to your, the other counsel here, we got to know whatever we decide today is going to bleed over into the next case. So we have to know where the line is. And
well, this court's...
You told me one line not to draw, which is supervision. The government does not have to supervise the contractor in any way for this to be a political question.
If that is the...
That's your point.
That's
right?
Correct. If that is the policy adopted by the United States government in the deployment of a civilian contractor, the political question doctrine would nevertheless apply. Because as this court's decisions make clear...
Let me ask one more question. I'm sorry. I don't mean to cut you off, but I do understand what you're saying. And you'd also take the position that they take, that even if the United States says in its regulations, the Army says in its regulations, that they are subject to supervision, that they are not subject to supervision or anything else, and they are subject to civil liability, which they said in the regulation, still the political question doctrine applies?
In this situation, that's correct.
Even if the United States in its regulations says they're subject to civil liability?
If it requires an examination of the underlying government policies, the political question doctrine bars that action.
So the court, notwithstanding the role of the executive, we should not intervene here. Notwithstanding the executive's view that civil liability is okay, we should not intervene here. Civil liability should not be okay because that would be a political question.
I don't think the court can read that regulation as permitting state regulation of combatant activities.
Was there any other kind of civil liability they could?
Under various scenarios, it's conceivable there could be a federal statutory claim or federal common law claim that might be asserted against a civilian contractor. That's not present here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Burke. Ms. Burke, could I ask you to answer, if you can, what I thought was a very powerful argument by opposing counsel on the argument you raised at the end,
sure.
which is the argument about the Westfall Act, which is you really are between a rock and a hard place. That is, this has to be within the scope of employment, otherwise you can't collect against the contractor.
No, that's actually not correct, because what you're looking at is you're looking at the corporation in the position of the soldier. And so with the soldier, you're looking at a scope of employment. But to determine whether or not the contractor is in that same position, you're not looking at employment. It's not an employment relationship. You're going to look at the contract terms.
I'm still not following. If the soldiers, if the linguists and the interrogators here were not acting within the scope of their employment,
With the corporate defendant.
Yeah, hold on. Let me go one step at a time.
Okay.
If they are not acting within the scope of their employment, D.C. law would not allow you to get recovery from their employer, right?
Yes, Your Honor. And our position is that the linguists were within the scope of employment because, as Judge Kavanaugh explained,
when they did the torturing.
Yes, because the scope of employment, the way it's defined in D.C., is so broad that it's basically are you on duty type of analysis.
Okay, so that would mean then that they, if this were a Westfall case, they'd get a Westfall certificate?
No, because that's where you're not looking at them as employees of the government. What the government analysis would be, the equivalent to the Westfall, would not be a scope of employment. It would be whether or not they abided by the contractual duties, because it's a contractual relationship between these private parties and the government. It's not an employment relationship. So what you would be looking for, the equivalent of a Westfall certification in this context, and what's missing, you know, what's not here, the equivalent would be a United States declaration that when they were doing those actions, when Titan and its employees were doing those actions, they were performing the contractual duties that the United States had asked them to do. They were within the scope of the contract. And so there, you know, that would be an independent contractor's Westfall equivalent. And there you can see quite clearly that
Judge Kavanaugh's point that normally in these cases we look at D.C. law about scope of employment, and for the reasons Judge Kavanaugh explained in his opinion, which, points out how difficult it is to believe, but nonetheless is true, you know, rapes by delivery men are included.
But
under D.C. law.
I understand that, sir, but what that really goes to is the employment relationship. What you would be doing in order to determine whether a private corporation that contracted with the government is in the same status as a soldier is you would look at that relationship. You'd look at the relationship between the United States and between Titan and its employees. And so when you look at that, you don't have to get to the notion of employment law. You're really in the zone of contract law. And you would be asking the United States, is what they did within the terms of what you asked them to do? Because you didn't employ them. You didn't ask them just to go over and do whatever it is you wanted them to do. You asked them to go over and do a specific task, translation. And the contract terms, which are in the record, are very clear. Do the translation and make sure you do it in accord with the laws of war. So that would be the appropriate analysis when you are looking for the United States to speak in the equivalent of a Westfall situation.
I take you into another question. Is it your position that under the Federal Tort Claims Act
mm-hmm.
and the exemption for combat activities, a private contractor for the government could never under any circumstances be entitled to that exemption?
The scope...
The exemption would never cover a lawsuit against the private contractor.
The scope of that exemption wouldn't decide that. It would be the scope of the implied preemption. So if you had a situation in which the contractor abided by its contract and complied with all the terms, and that contractual compliance served to benefit the United States and served to further that combatant interest, to get the government's job done, then you may be in the same situation as you are in Boyle, where you had contract compliance that furthered the government's interest. Now, you could never have that type of
You're not making any argument to the effect that there could not be liability to a government contractor under the combat activities exemption.
It does not turn – that decision does not turn on the text of the FTCA. It turns on that the scope of the common law Boyle doctrine.
Well, in other words, I just want to make sure.
Yeah.
I understand that that exemption could be there based on the statute plus Boyle.
That's correct, Your Honor, but under that analysis.
And it's a the question for us would be the proper interpretation of Boyle in that context. But isn't it fair to say that the exemption is broader for combat activities than it is with respect to the discretionary action, because the discretionary action focuses on specific actions of the government, whereas the combat activities is broader language. It arises out of the combat activities. On its face, it could cover, on that language, on its face, could cover other than the government.
Well, you know, in a sense, and this is an unsatisfactory answer, but yes and no, because the combatant activities exception really subsumes within it the phrase the combatant, and so it has the whole law of war, the federal common law of war within it. So there is more definiteness to that than the words themselves may imply.
You don't have any doubt that in this case the judge was right in concluding that there was war and there were combatant activities.
There was definitely war, and there was definitely combatant activities. Now, there was not the activities themselves. The cause of action, what arose here, did not actually happen in combat.
Doesn't matter. It's still combat.
It's activity. Still within the combatant activities, because that is a broader term than combat. But we would say, and this is really what we'll get to with the khaki argument. But the duty of care is different in combat than it is in that broader zone of combatant activities.
A lot of this seems to turn on conflict preemption versus field preemption and some of what we've been talking about. And I want to ask you about Garamendi, which the intervener noted and which I raised before. In footnote 11 of Garamendi, in terms of this real key, is there a conflict or is the field preempted?
Right.
It says, if a state were simply to take a position on a matter of foreign policy with no serious claim to be addressing a traditional state responsibility, field preemption might be the appropriate doctrine, whether the national government had acted, and if it had, without reference to the degree of any conflict, the principle having been established that the Constitution entrusts foreign policy exclusively to the national government. And then that footnote cites Hines, and then it cites Boyle.
And, Your Honor, what I understand from that is that what that is saying is that if, for example, you know, the state of Texas passed a law that said, you know, the war in Iraq is illegal and no Texans can go fight, that would be an issue of field preemption. I do not think that has any
– Doesn't it require us to ask how much interest does the District of Columbia law have in the relations that take place in Iraq in these circumstances as compared to the federal government?
No, what it really asks you to do...
Is it fair to say that District of Columbia has almost no interest in this at all?
Your Honor, what Boyle asks you to do is ask, okay, does the regular course of tort litigation in D.C., those regular duties that apply to all corporations, do those conflict? Is there some type of conflict that would intrude on the sovereign if you let...
Well, I thought that footnote perhaps asked a broader question.
I don't understand it, sir. I do think that the federal common law that you are looking at here is one of an extension of sovereign immunity. So you.
We switched from federal common law, but I was talking about D.C. law for a moment. D.C. law, and it's fair if this is any kind of balancing test. D.C. law, D.C.'s interests are pretty minimal. Isn't that correct?
Well, Your Honor, what you
isn't it fair to say that D.C.'s law, D.C.'s interest is minimal, almost trivial?
I don't know, because to me, every American in every state has an interest in ensuring that the Americans abide by the law of war, and I don't think that the geographic situation of where you are changes that interest. So the question really is: does the application of D.C. law further our national interest of ensuring?
Well, the states could define that interest quite differently. One state could put heavy punitive damages on a case like this. Another state might not. Some states might give the state attorney general the ability to bring suits against military contractors. Other states might not. And some states might define the laws of war, which are not always crystal clear differently from how other states do it. There'd be a patchwork of state laws regulating U.S. military contractors in war zones, wouldn't there?
There would be a patchwork of laws that apply to U.S. military contractors. There is now, and there likely always will be. If you're a defense contractor, merely by the fact that you are hired to assist with war doesn't suddenly insulate you from acting, you know, in accord with all of the different state regulation. So there's no reason to displace the entirety.
What was the contract here between CACI and the government? Did it state what the law would apply for the interpretation?
It did not speak to it did not speak to the issue of which law should apply. It did put an affirmative duty to abide by the federal law.
Can I ask you?
I'm a little curious. So why is D.C. law involved at all?
D.C. law is
the contract.
D.C. law is not being looked to provide the rule of decision for the governing of the contract. Rather, it is that these claims, the claims being made, the type of conduct at issue, basically violates the state law, the federal law, the international law.
We'll get to the federal and international separately. I'm curious now about, the more I think about this, you could theoretically have 50 different state laws applying to this contractors under your theory.
No, you couldn't, because that's exactly the point of Boyle. You are looking to see whether there's a conflict, and you're looking to see whether...
Well, now, wait a minute. You said that D.C. law, federal law would have governed the interpretation of the contract, but D.C. law governs the implementation of the contract.
No, I'm sorry, Your Honor, it's not, because we are not suing under contract.
No, but, right? But you're suing... alleging the implementation of the contract was a tort.
Well, right. We are suing under basically...
Why does that necessarily bring into question the contract? As a matter of fact, Judge Garland was looking at the contract. But now you're telling me, Joe, no, this has got nothing to do with the contract because, after all, D.C. law couldn't interpret the contract.
What I'm saying is that what we are looking at is corporate liability for breaching a duty. And the duty of care is the duty to refrain from physically harming the people that are in detention.
Duty of care under what law?
The duty of care under all law. The duty.
No. That won't work.
Well, it's,
we have to be a little bit more.
Well, specific. We have not. We
in
have
words,
not.
Is there DC, right. DC laws involved here? Is it correct?
Well, we have not actually reached that point in the proceedings where we've briefed which law would apply. So it has
Iraqi
not.
Iraqi law apply.
Sorry? Yes, Iraqi law, you know, there is a theoretical train of events. You could say, okay, Iraqi law would apply. You could say D.C. law would apply, which is frankly why the federal common law under the color of authority in ATS is the cleaner way to go.
In the state common law claim, the treatment of prisoners in a war zone by U.S. military contractors could be governed by the enemy's law.
It's not that, because you could not apply enemy law to the claims.
The enemy country's law.
No, but you could not because
Iraq
of the.
Iraq was the enemy country, correct?
At the time of this episode, no, it had already.
Hypothetically, this was in March of 2003.
Then it would be a different analysis, because then you wouldn't have the restatement factors coming in to say, you know, you would have a public interest issue that you would never apply enemy law because you have the public interest there. And so when we look at the conflict of law analysis, which we have not briefed and has not been done in this proceeding yet.
It's still possible that the judge would hold that the District of Columbia has no interest in this or insufficient interest to assert its authority and dismiss this case on the merits.
He could do that. The other way.
Isn't that relevant in the preemption analysis?
The preemption really looks to ascertain whether there's a conflict by applying the tort law with the federal interest.
You're asking that you're saying the preemption analysis should look only at the federal side of the balancing test, not at the countervailing side.
No, when...
In Boyle, there was a consideration of both sides, wasn't there?
Yes, and if you look in the Murray case...
Why isn't it what law you're relying on relevant to the preemption analysis?
And, Your Honor, I'm not saying that it's not relevant. What I'm saying is that although...
It's not relevant, but you don't want to tell me what it is.
It's not that, Your Honor. It's that it may be... And the reason I speak in kind of generalities about all law is because it has not yet been ruled on which law. But assuming that it's D.C. law... Assuming that we state a D.C. law, then you look at it and say, all right, the D.C. law on, say, assault and battery. Would applying the D.C. law on assault and battery create a conflict with the federal sovereign interest that's at play here? And when you look at it that way, you say, okay, well, what is the federal sovereign interest? The federal sovereign interest is defined by the executive and by the executive's proclamations and by the executive determinations that that Iraq war should abide by the Geneva Conventions. So the reason that you do not get a conflict and you're in a Murray situation rather than a Boyle situation is because the application of the state law yields the same result that's sought by the United States in its contract.
You've appropriately, for your position, used the word conflict repeatedly, and it goes back really to this question. Is this a conflict situation or is this a field situation? And that footnote, again, referred, and Boyle has similar analysis, to whether something's an area of traditional state responsibility. Is regulating foreign detainees in a war situation a traditional state responsibility, I guess, is a relevant question.
And the answer, Your Honor, is no. I mean, it is not...
Then kick it into a field preemption type of situation.
No, because you only what you're looking at in Boyle and you're looking at in that implied preemption is protecting the sovereign. How do we protect the sovereign in the circumstances that are at hand here and in the circumstances that may arise in the future by your rule of law? And so you have to start the analysis with the federal interest. And the federal interest, there is a federal interest in war making, but there is a federal interest in lawful war making. The federal interest is to make sure that Americans engage in conduct that's befitting of Americans and that is consistent with the law of war. So
let me ask you a question about that. If the government, let's assume the government contractor here was doing precisely what the military wished him to do in every jot and tittle. Complete exclusive operational control, although I'm not sure that's an appropriate standard. But let's assume that was true. As a factual matter, put aside whatever the contract said. That's the way it operated. Why is it, in your view, in the government's interest for the contractor to be liable to a private party?
In that particular situation, you would be saying, and this really gets into the analysis of the conduct itself. Because take the example of the putting the men in the naked pyramid. If the government said to do that, and it was government officials saying to a private contractor, I want you to go and stack those men up. Then you would have that government sovereign interest in both the discretionary function and the war making that, okay, it is to be done this way. But you then clearly get off into this separate issue, which is can the United States, qua United States, do that? And it would turn on whether you had a sovereign statement, whether you had the Department of Justice coming in and saying, yes, this is what the officials did, and that's what they're allowed to do, and therefore it's in the sovereign interest that this claim not proceed against the private party. We don't have that here.
Suppose you did.
It would be a different case.
Suppose you did. What would be the answer?
I think if that were the situation, then the court would end up having to defer to the sovereign's definition of the war-making interest. But that's not what we're confronting here. What we're confronting is a situation in which the three military witnesses that testified uniformly. They did not supervise.
Pause over this for just 1 second. Your position is that if the government expressly orders the contractor to commit a war crime for no reason relating to the collection of information or anything else, other than to torture prisoners being held, detainees or prisoners, however you call it, you're giving up under those circumstances?
Well, Your Honor, I don't.
To me, you ha- I'm not saying you shouldn't or you should. I just want to be clear.
Well, Your Honor, I think
that... The answer to Judge Silverman seems to me that you say, okay, you lose under those circumstances. Is that right?
Your Honor, what you're really getting to there is the power of the United States judiciary then in the to step in on the war making.
I'm only asking about a preemption question. In your position, in your view is that liability is preempted if the United States clearly and expressly authorizes, orders a contractor to do something that is clearly against the law of the United States, the law of war, every other kind of law, and with no instrumental purpose. Your position, I just want to know, your position is that that's civil liability is preempted.
Well, Your Honor, I guess the answer is no, because it's hard to envision a case when you have the Department of Justice.
Just for the moment here.
But what you are envisioning is you're envisioning a case, what Judge Silverman laid out as the hypothetical, you're envisioning the case where the Department of Justice has opined that something that was wholly illegal was in fact not wholly illegal. And so, you know, we're basically getting beyond the limits of my expertise here, because then you're...
Let's leave the Justice Department out of this for the moment.
Well, I think that was the situation.
All right. Oh, I see. So your answer to him was based on there being a legal opinion from the Justice Department.
That insulated the contractors in kind of the government made me do it. Because their Boyle defense is basically...
I'm sorry.
So, no broader than that. But
in that case, there'd be the conflict that you're...
There would be the conflict that we're talking about that's not this case. And I did not mean to go beyond that in any way.
It's my fault. Must have lost the train of the argument.
Okay.
No, you did.
Thank you.
I guess we're going to call the next case.
Case number 087007001 et al. Saleh, an individual et al. Versus CACI International, Inc., a Delaware corporation et al. Appellants. Mr. Cagle for the appellants, Ms. Burke for the appellees.
Shall I proceed, Judge Garland?
Please.
May it please the court.
We already know you.
The issue in this appeal is whether state tort law should apply to the combatant activities of the military when performed by a civilian contractor. We submit that whether the court chooses to engage in the analysis of field preemption or the conflict preemption analysis, the result is the same. The state law claims are preempted. In these cases, the plaintiffs seek to inject themselves, the federal courts, and the substantive tort law of some unspecified jurisdiction into the process of second-guessing interrogation policies and practices in Iraq. That exercise necessarily conflicts with the inherently and unique federal interest in waging war and the federal interest recognized in Boyle in the regulation of government contractors.
Does it matter at all that the government has, to the extent it can, disowned these interrogation policies, that no one in the government is defending it, that the president at the time and the president elect, or the president who is now the president, but as a candidate, both disown these that Secretary Rumsfeld disowned them, not to the question of whether there was supervision, but the question of whether this kind of behavior was beyond the pale.
Judge Garland, what record references are you making?
Right, I'm only talking about the public record of the president's statements.
I believe Judge Garland's referring to executive order. I believe it's 39421, issued by President Obama on January 22nd, in which
that's true with respect to him, and then with respect to President Bush, there was a press conference in which he said this, and Rumsfeld at the hearing said this. Unless you, I mean, you're free to...
That overstates, I believe, the content of that press conference.
Okay.
I do not believe the President or the Secretary of Defense or any other individual in a position of responsibility repudiated or otherwise rescinded the interrogation rules of engagement that were
in effect. That's why I'm trying to be careful about this. So we use the hypothetical provided by the opposing side. No one in a position of authority in the United States government has ever said that piling people up in a naked pyramid is lawful, appropriate, or any other way aimed at yielding information in interrogations. I'm not wrong about that, am I?
You're correct.
All right. So imagine there were that circumstance where there is no, there's just no argument from any government official or even from the people who did it that they were doing this for the purpose of getting information. Under those circumstances, I'm going to ask you the same question I asked you before, which is about political question, but we're not talking about political question now. Is your position still that it would be preempted and that it would be bad for the courts to look into that question, even with the executive's blessing?
If the claims arise out of the combatant activities of the military, that's correct, Judge Garland. That exception to the FTCA, however, is not the only basis for the court.
The last word that the Judge Garland asked was with the executive blessing. We do not have an executive position in this case, do we?
We do not have a statement of interest from the United States, Judge Silverman. You're correct.
That's what I was asking you. I understand that point. And I'm just asking, is the implication of where we're going here that if the executive came in and said, say, we get past this case and it goes to the Supreme Court and an amicus, the Solicitor General, says this is beyond the pale. Government completely and totally disowns this. That wouldn't make any difference with your analysis?
I don't believe that it would, Judge Garland, because the Constitution commits the warfighting prerogative to the executive and to the Congress, to the federal government exclusively. It affirmatively prohibits the states from regulating foreign affairs, including waging war. You take those constitutional provisions combined with the congressional determination reflected in the combatant activities exception to the FTCA, a clear congressional determination that there should be no claims arising out of the combatant activities during time of war.
One could easily imagine the government taking the position that the activities alleged here should be criminally prosecuted, but there should be no civil liability under the Federal Tort Claims Act.
That's correct, Judge Silverman, and that, of course, reflects the executive prerogative to conduct precisely such an investigation and prosecution.
I understand that. And that's why I'm sorry to push this hypothetical. I know I'm pushing you in an uncomfortable area, but I do want to know. Imagine Congress passed a statute that said contractors are civilly liable under state law, and imagine the president said contractors are civilly liable under state law, and both of them said this would not interfere with the executive's war, either with congressional war power or with the executive's power to wage war. The court, your position is the court should still say that it would?
Would, in your hypothetical, Judge Garland, Congress be amending the combatant activities exception to the FTCA?
Just amend the FTCA to say we want to be clear that the Boyle analysis does not apply to the combatant exception, and there are no circumstances under which a contractor is immune.
Congress could not, consistent with the Constitution, delegate responsibility to the states.
Well, sure,
for
it can borrow
regulating.
State. It can create a cause of action borrowing state law, or it can enact a statute indicating that state law is not preempted in an area. It could do that.
I don't believe
that your Congress political question theory would throw that out, but your preemption theory would allow that kind of suit to go forward, as I understand your two theories.
Perhaps, Judge Kavanaugh, although
in this
Congress
case, you'll take Judge Kavanaugh's answer.
The Congress could not assign to the states a role in regulating waging war. The Constitution.
I'm not sure about that, but anyway.
The Constitution reserves that exclusively to the federal government.
Can't the executive say
what about the National Guard?
That's correct, Judge Kavanaugh, but that would not necessarily fall within conducting foreign relations of the United States. In fact,
well, it's war.
Shure versus Rhodes is a good example of that, where the federal government in a non-wartime context had not asserted the political question doctrine. It was a domestic security matter involving the National Guard. The political question doctrine was neither raised nor viewed as precluding the causes of action there.
We're getting pretty far afield.
Yeah. Go ahead. This is the problem of having a professor on my left here. Am I right?
The district court here fashioned a new test for combatant activities preemption, and we submit that test is fundamentally flawed, requiring.
I take it that any test would be new, right? Because we don't have a.
In this circuit, that's correct, Judge Garland.
We don't have anyone in which contractors acting in this way, that is, not as providing a product, but as actually acting as if they were combatants, under your view. There's no case on that, is there?
In this circuit, that's
correct. In any circuit. Is there one in any circuit? The California, the Ninth Circuit case is they produced a product which American soldiers actually use.
There are lower court decisions, but not at the appellate level. There are some decisions in which services.
Uhay and Johnson, but they're not really directly on the question of how do you define combat.
So I'm saying is can't blame the district court for designing a new test when there was no test to begin with.
We believe that the CUI decision supplies the correct test. The court need only look at whether the complaint of activities constituted combatant activities of the military during time of war. That should be dispositive as to whether preemption applies.
The gun in that case was fired by a member of the United States military. It wasn't fired by an independent contractor. The actual physical activity was done by...
That's correct.
The question was the
Aegis missile defense
system. Product liability issue about the Aegis, but it wasn't a question of the actual direct application.
But the same federal interests that support preemption with respect to a product liability case support preemption where there are services involved. The federal interest is the same.
I understand that. I just wonder whether the test has to be the same, that's all.
Well, for combatant activities, which admittedly is a broader exception to the FTCA than the discretionary function exception, requiring exclusive operational control conflicts with the very nature of the combatant activities exception. It imposes a duty of care on the battlefield. It subjects military commanders.
Suppose a government contractor working for Iraq, not for the United States government, had been in Baghdad when a firefight developed. And the government contractor, perhaps, wasn't there one once off hired by Perot, as I recall, for an independent action. I don't know whether it was in Iraq. But suppose I'm talking about a corporation, not necessarily a government contractor, but even a government contractor who was not dealing with the military in any way was drawn into a conflict and used force. Would that individual, that contractor, be entitled to an exemption under the FTCA?
As I understand your hypothetical, perhaps not, Judge Silberman, because those activities wouldn't be combatant activities of the military, which is one of the tests inherent in the combatant activities exception. It's not all combatant activities.
Well, it would arise out of combatant activities of the military, but it would involve someone who did not have any privity with the military.
It's difficult to imagine a scenario where there's a lack of privity with the United States.
The privity is essential.
I think privity would be, in certainly most instances at least, indispensable to constituting combatant activities of the military. That reflects the government's interest in the control of how war is waged. And absent that privity, it's difficult to reconcile the federal interest in waging war.
Garland early on said, after all, the statute exempts government contractors.
The statute provides immunity. It preempts claims against government contractors. It immunizes claims against.
He means express. Judge Silver's asking about the express language, not implied preemption. There's an exception. There's a independent contractor. There's a contractor exclusion, right, with respect to the government's ability to get...
For the discretionary function exception, that's correct, Judge Garland. But on that point...
I thought Judge Garland was reading the statute to say there was a general exception for government contractors. Do you have a statute in front of you?
I didn't actually mean to define exactly how they applied. So there's two. One, it says... term federal agency does not include any contractor with the United States. And the second, employee of the government also doesn't.
Does that apply to the combat activities exception? You have the statute in front of you?
I do not, Judge Silberman. I believe it applies to the discretionary function exception. I'm not at all certain it applies to the combatant activities exception. But it's important to note that...
Well, let's see if we nail that down.
That Westfall...
Let me just see if we nail it down now. Does it? Or I know you can argue that Boyle has made this extension, but I wondered what the literal language of the statute said. Could be because that one uses employee.
Assuming that that caveat applies to contractors.
Well,
doesn't?
This is sort of an. I grant you, we can go to Boyle, but I would. I'm trying to get the sense of what the exact language of the statute means, and I was a little surprised at what Judge Garland said earlier. And I thought you would certainly be familiar with the exact language. Well, is there a provision in the statute which limits the exemption for activities to limits the exemption for government contractors?
For the discretionary function, yes.
But not there's not a provision on for the combat activities?
I need to check into that. I don't believe that it
I don't understand
that,
why
that caveat applies to government
in this case
contractors.
Of this importance, why nobody would have that right at their fingertips. Does anybody have it?
Okay. We'll worry
you
about
caused
that.
So much
I'm
trouble.
Sorry.
Judge Silberman, the statute by definition applies to government employees, and it also defines employees, and it has also been held to apply to agents of the government. So even if the exclusion applies,
or it's been held.
It has been that has been held.
Right, so there are a series of cases about contractors, and it depends on right physical control over the
agency country. Is determined based upon the day-to-day control right. of the duties of the contractor.
That's not
under
your position here. You don't think there has to be any day-to-day control, right?
Not for preemption under the combatant activities exception. Given the unique federal interest in
explain
conducting
why
war.
Explain why you think that is a broader term than the discretionary function exemption.
Discretionary function protects the policymaking prerogatives of the United States. And in Boyle, the Supreme Court determined that it was necessary to fashion a two-part test.
Although the language specifies the discretionary activities of the government, right? And Boyle had to take an extension, a considerable extension under the preemption theory in order to reach the
That's
contractor.
Correct.
But the direct language of the combat activities language, the direct language of that section easily applies to government contractors on its face.
That's our position, Judge Silberman.
That now, you add Boyle to it, but you don't really need it.
And you add the constitutional provisions that prohibit the states from regulating foreign affairs, including the conduct of war. Taken alone or taken together, they lead to preemption. In this case, the district court found that the exclusive operational control test was not satisfied, and we submitted there were two fundamental flaws in that. The district court failed to define what it meant by operational control, and in the process, completely ignored the military's definition of operational control. And under that definition...
Isn't your theory that the operational control is a misnomer anyway? You're asking whether the contractor's activities are integrated in with the military and under the ultimate control of the military. Isn't that your basic point?
If the activities constitute combatant activities of the military, that's sufficient for preemption. The court might inquire into the degree of control for purposes of assessing whether the activities are
of
the military.
Your position is a little broader than, because of the way the case turned out, than counsel in the previous case, right?
That's correct.
That's right. He was willing to accept the court's definition with respect to kind of supervision that's provided, and you're taking you want to take both positions. You want to say, even taking the court's position, you're right, but otherwise there should just be broad field preemption, essentially.
No, wait a minute. I don't think you're saying field preemption. Excuse me. You're saying there would the exemption for our combat activities would cover a contractor who is integrated in with the military
yes.
and under the mission control of the military. And
precisely.
You wouldn't look at exclusive operation control. You'd ask the basic functional question.
That's correct.
Yes.
Looking at exclusive.
You said that plus field preemption just now, didn't you? Because you said taking the constitutional structure, and you said taking them separately or together.
You would add field preemption to it, but you don't need it.
That's correct.
But you didn't argue for that in your brief. This is.
That's correct.
Well, yeah, you did.
Well, we.
Page 29 to 31, you didn't. It's responded to on 52 to 54 of the red brief.
We argue that in the context of the unique federal interest because we're here on a 1292B appeal where the only issue before the court is the combatant activities preemption test adopted by the district court. We take issue with that test and in doing so reflect the unique federal interest in waging war as reflected in the constitutional provisions that assign responsibility exclusively to the federal government for that. As a result, that field is occupied by...
You had those as two separate arguments in your district court briefs and then they're melded. And
that's correct. And which is why I began this argument by saying whether the court goes through field preemption analysis or conflict analysis, the result is the same.
I have a question I meant to ask Mr. Zimmelman, and I apologize for not asking you because you were very good at answering my questions, but you have a stand-in here for this one. So if the, under the UCMJ, if the military supervisor of the contract ordered the contractor to do something, that is the individual employee, and they refused the order, could they be punished under the UCMJ?
The UCMJ is applied to civilian contractors now.
Going forward, right?
Going forward.
And it wasn't applied at that time.
It was not in – the UCMJ was not applicable at the time of the actions complained of here. On a going forward basis, I believe that, yes, the contractor could be
– Even refusing to follow an order? I'm not talking about don't do a war crime. I'm talking about any order. Your understanding is that the UCM – I have no idea what the answer is.
I can't –
In order to figure out whether these people are like soldiers, I appreciate this may be totally irrelevant to your own analysis, but it's helpful to mine. I guess what I want to know is, even if they are in the chain of command, are they subject to punishment for – other than, you know, you're out of the contract or we don't pay you. Are they subject to military punishment for refusing an order the way a normal soldier would be?
I can't give you an exhaustive answer to that question right now, Judge Garland.
You mean unexhausted or can't give me any kind?
What is about the question – you recall the question I asked the other side in this case, which is since the district judge relied importantly, as Judge Garland said, not exclusively, but importantly on the proposition that the supervisor there, this civilian supervisor, testified that he could have complained about behavior up through the civil ranks, up through the contractor's ranks, about behavior he thought was abusive. You recall that I asked counsel if that was a factor to be used to apply liability, wouldn't that have an absolutely perverse economic incentive, creating a situation where government contractors were not supposed to object to war crimes?
Absolutely, Judge Silverman, and it would also be inconsistent with the DFARS regulation that requires a civilian contractor to have a code of ethics and that code of ethics must require the reporting of wrongdoing.
And what is the DFARS regulation?
The DFARS regulation, which is set forth in our brief, and I'll give you the page number for that, Judge Silverman. We reference this because when Judge Robertson concluded that the presence of CACI's code of ethics might be viewed as establishing a dual chain of command, he did so without awareness of DFARS 48 CFR 203.7000 to .7001. It's set forth on page 53 and 54 of our brief. We believe that it's counterintuitive for a contractor to be penalized for having a code of ethics that requires wrongdoing, but worse yet,
requires reporting of wrongdoing.
Reporting of wrongdoing, but worse yet, when that code of ethics is affirmatively required by federal regulation, that's an indicia of more rather than less control of the contractor.
That makes it another boil point.
That's correct.
Because the government is requiring you to do.
The government required the company to
have. You're really being hoisted on your own petard.
We were penalized for compliance with a Defense Department regulation. That's exactly correct.
Okay. Like every other attorney, you're way over your time, but it's because of us and not you, Ms. Burke. We have exhausted ourselves, I think.
What CACI is asking you to do is to substitute a corporate view of what's in the military's interests with the military's view of what's in their interest. The military has spoken on the issue as to whether or not it benefits the military to have private.
Why don't they speak to this court, then?
Well, Your Honor, I think that if you asked them to, they would. Seriously, I mean, we have met with the Department of Justice. I think that, you know, they have not filed a statement of interest. I think that the, you know, the litigation branch of the military has been very actively involved in this, has attended all the depositions. And I think that the military's regulations, which set out very straightforwardly their view, and the statutory law that makes it clear that corporations remain subject to civil liability, the military goes in with the expectation that that looming specter of tort law is one of the things that makes sure corporations abide by all the laws and continue to perform as the military expects them to do in a lawful manner. The situation that you have when you...
I'm clear, the military informs contractors, at least back at the time, that they may be subject to state tort laws and to international law-based ATS claims?
The regulations and the military's information provided to the contractors makes it clear that they are subject to all U.S. law, all U.S. law. So there's no going.
D.C. law is U.S. law.
It's one of the United States laws, and I think that you know the real question here is when you take away the.
Wait a minute, counsel. You don't mean to suggest that the contractor could be liable to tort and contract law of 50 different states.
What I'm saying,
all of which might be quite different.
What I'm saying, Your Honor, is that when the military hires a private corporation and tells them to abide by the law, that the military is well aware of the fact that one of the mechanisms in our system of American jurisprudence that keeps corporations abiding by the law is the specter of tort liability. And that the military has looked at this issue.
Is there any evidence of that?
Your Honor, if you look at the comments by the military in the regulations, they were very clear.
Back at the time?
If you look at, well, there's a couple different things in the record on the, and I'll need to get you the record sites, but if you look at the contracts themselves, which are at our JA 319 to 368, the contracts themselves talk about that. And then there are manuals as well that are in the record that also talk about contractor being subject to the liability.
To the liability?
To tort liability, to private liability.
Was there some kind of status of forces agreement that protected the contractors from host country liability in Iraq?
Your Honor, there was what was called the Bremer Order, and the Bremer Order said that that contractors operating in Iraq were not subject to Iraqi jurisdiction, and that the sovereign could waive that.
Which sovereign are we talking about?
The United States. It's a United States order.
The possibility of Iraqi law governing here?
Your Honor, that the Bremer Order referred to Iraqi jurisdiction so that they couldn't be hauled into the courts in Iraq. I think it would be cited as evidence that by the state courts that you would not apply Iraqi law. It would be one indicia that was not where.
But as you said earlier, Iraqi law could apply.
And
on the conflict of laws theory.
Well, what I said is that all laws of all civilized nations, including Iraq, prohibit torture. So that you don't end up with a conflicts of law analysis because the conduct is so egregious. So we don't get to the harder question of, you know, any kind of difference between law.
A number of the allegations of abuse that you make are not torture under anybody's theory.
Well, Your Honor, I think that the...
correct? Your allegations are much broader than torture.
No, Your Honor, if you look at the...
You go to abuse, don't you?
Well, if you look at the conduct that's alleged for each individual, every individual was subjected to a level of physical force that that rose to the level of torture.
I thought your allegations were broader than that. They included abuse.
Well, I mean, part of it, of course, is the definition of torture. And so when you look at, when we're looking at it, the Geneva Conventions, that you're not to use any physical force, they all involve physical force.
But that doesn't necessarily mean torture.
You're right, Your Honor. And we are, I mean, this is not the, the label of...
The allegations are broader than torture.
Yeah, Your Honor, the allegations turn on the physical force. Whether or not those are labeled definitionally as torture or not really doesn't matter, because we're talking about assault and batteries. And so, you know, if, for example, you know, something like...
So assault and battery would be covered by the law of nations as well.
The and one of the ways to look at it is... Yes. Yes, in this context it would be, because one of the ways to look at it...
When you say this context, are we on the ATS issue now, or are we on just your civil liability claim?
If you look at...
Which are you talking about?
I'm talking about under the federal common law,
That's the ATS.
If you look at the law of war...
You're talking about ATS
now. Yes, yes. So if you look at the law of war, the word torture... goes to the use in a coercive environment for the purposes of gathering the intelligence. The physical harms, the stacking the people up in the pyramid, not necessarily torture, but it is a violation. It's a violation of the duty not to inflict physical harm on the detainees. And this really goes to the point of the duty of care and why the argument made by CACI, well, that the combatant activities exception eliminates any duty of care, is not accurate, because when we're looking under federal common law, we're just on the federal side here now, and you have the federal common law incorporating the law of war, the law of war does not eliminate a duty of care. The law of war does the opposite. It makes specific when there are duties of care. And one of the places in which there is a duty of care is when people are detained. They're no longer out in the battlefield. They're not...
Do I understand correctly that you must be applying on the Federal Tort Claim Act case either D.C. law or Iraqi law? It has to be one of those two options?
No, it could be California. We originally sued in California so that we could bring...
It has to be one of those three?
Yes. Okay. Yes.
One of the briefs, I thought, said it was, you were relying on D.C. law. Your brief in one of these cases responded to the claim that you were applying Iraqi law.
Hinted.
Maybe it only
yes,
hinted.
And that's...
Are you withdrawing your hint now?
The reality is that we have not briefed this, and so we have not taken a position in the litigation. I think that...
Every single position you could take might actually make you lose all of your positions.
And I think that...
You might want to think about that just for a minute.
Well, then we will take D.C. law. and we will apply D.C. law. And so going forward, the state law that we will be arguing applies would be the law of D.C. And our point remains that, you know, that does not create any conflicts of law issues. So if you look at the duty of care that would arise under the D.C. assault and battery and the duty of care under the federal common law of war, it's the same duty. So you do not get into the situation. You are in a Murray situation rather than a Boyle situation or the third bucket.
And Congress extended the UCMJ to contractors after this incident became known. Why didn't it create a federal civil cause of action? Do you have any information about whether something was proposed along those lines or what the thinking was?
Well, I don't know whether the thinking was that under SOSA it already would be a federal cause of law of action or not. I don't have any information on what was considered.
Senator Feinstein proposed a bill that would have specified the various causes of action to eliminate what we're going through on the ATS issue. But I was thinking a more general federal civil cause of action, but you're not aware of anything targeted to contractors specifically.
I'm sorry. I'm not familiar enough with all the proposed legislation to really speak knowledgeably. And there may well have been one, and I may not know of it or have forgotten it.
In any event, the question still is how to interpret that in actions.
Yes. Yes. And so certainly for our purposes, there was no legislation that we could look to answer these questions.
You exhausted?
I am a bit tired, but I'm happy to answer any further questions.
Hearing none, we'll take the matter under consideration. We're great. Oh, no, you get a reply. You get a reply. But a little shorter, since she didn't take all of her time.
I'll be brief.
Okay.
In response to your earlier question, Judge Garland, when Congress amended Article 2 of the Uniform Code of Military Justice to render contractors in the field subject to the law, it did include Article 92, failure to obey an order, and Article 134, conduct contrary to good order and discipline, as applicable to civilian contractors. So, yes, they could be charged and disciplined for failure to obey an order.
That's going forward from 2007 or something like that?
That's correct. Yes. And in response to Judge Kavanaugh's question about the amendment to the UCMJ, Senator Graham's amendment was included without debate or committee consideration. And as a result, there is no amplified discussion on the decision that Congress made to extend UCMJ to contractors in the field. It was done very, very quickly and without any congressional debate or discussion.
I just ask back on the other one. Imagine there weren't any contract here at all, but you had the regulations that said that the contractor, or maybe you had both a contract and you had regulations that said the contractors are not in the chain of command, they are not supervised by the military. Imagine it said they are supervised only by civilian supervisors. Would the UCMJ require them to follow an order of? Could they be punished for not following an order, which would really be an illegal order under those circumstances? See, I'm having this difficulty with the regulations, right? I understand all the other arguments, but I'm having difficulty. The regulations say you're not in the chain of command and you're not subject to command. Whether it actually happens in practice or not, I don't understand how there's authority for it to happen in practice. And therefore, I don't see how, even if the UCMJ covered it, somebody could be punished for following an order when the government's regulations and contracts say you don't have to follow orders.
I think there are several questions there, Judge Garland.
I'll
try to answer them in sequence. First, if there is a federal statute adopted by Congress that imposes affirmative obligations on a contractor, that's going to trump a Defense Department regulation.
So do you think the UCMJ says not only that they can be punished for not following lawful orders, but they can be punished for following orders even if there's no the UCMJ by itself is an obligation to follow orders regardless? Is that right?
Yes. Yes. In certain circumstances, that's correct, even in the absence of a contractual obligation.
And even in the face of regulations that say the opposite?
The regulations don't provide that it is impermissible for a contractor.
Because they're not subject to the direct command, and it says they're not in the chain of command.
And that's correct, Your Honor, although that is better read as a reference to administrative supervision, and we believe the Secretary of Defense and the Defense Department do have flexibility with respect to the formulation of government contracts, because the contract here that CACI had to provide interrogators is replete with references to being required to follow the direction and supervision.
Better read is not usually the argument that we follow before somebody can be put in the brig or before somebody could be put in jail. If the law is that unclear, in fact, if the express language seems otherwise. Are you saying that your employees from now on can be put in the brig for failing to follow an order, even if the contract and the regulations say they don't have to follow orders? I just wonder.
I don't believe that the government by contract can exempt a civilian contractor from federal law.
Okay.
That a government contracting officer.
You satisfied me. Do you have any other questions?
Anything? Thank you.
Well, Judge Silberman just nudged me that we're about 50 minutes, maybe an hour over.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. We appreciate this. This is a difficult case, and I thought the arguments were very good today. Appreciate it.